to a hostage's head. And anyway, I had a better idea, and it would depend on a show of compliance. So I just held the hammer and waited politely until Villanueva had the lid in place over the fat yellow missile tube. I buttered it with the heel of my hand until the nails found their original holes. Then I hammered them in and stood back and waited again. We did the second grail crate the same way, lifted it up and piled it back on top of the first one. Then we did the RPG-7s, nailed down the lids and stacked them exactly like we had found them. Then we did the VAL silent snipers. Harley watched us carefully, but he was relaxing a little. We were compliant. Villanueva seemed to understand what we were aiming for. He had caught on fast. He found the lid for the Makarov crate, paused with it halfway into position.
"People buy these things?" he said.
"Perfect," I thought. His tone was conversational and a little puzzled, and professionally interested, just like a real ATF guy might be.
"Why wouldn't they buy them?" Harley said.
"Because they're junk," I said. "You ever tried one?" Harley shook his head. "Let me show you something," I said. "Okay?" Harley kept the gun pressed hard against Duffy's temple.
"Show me what?"
I put my hand in the crate and came out with one of the pistols, blew wood shavings off it, and held it up. It was old and scratched, well used. Very crude mechanism. They simplified the original Walter design. Ruined it, really. Double action, like the original. But the pull, it's a nightmare. I pointed the gun at the ceiling and put my finger on the trigger and used just my thumb on the back of the butt to exaggerate the effect. Pincered my hand and pulled the trigger. The mechanism grated like a balky stick shift in an old car, and the gun twisted awkwardly in my grip. "Piece of junk," I said. I did it again, listening to the bad sound and letting the gun twist and rock between my finger and thumb. "Hopeless. No chance of hitting anything unless it's right next to you." I tossed the gun back into the crate. Villanueva slid the lid into position.
"You should be worried, Harley," he said. "Your reputation won't be worth shit if you put junk like this on the street."
"Not my problem," Harley said. "Not my reputation. I just work here."
I hammered the nails back in, slowly, like I was tired. Then we started on the AKSU-74 crate, the old submachine guns. Then we did the AK-74s.
"You could sell these in the movies," Villanueva said, "for historical dramas. That's about all they're good for."
I hammered the nails into position, and we stacked the crate with the others until we had all of Bizarre Bazaar's imports back into a neat, separate pile, just like we had found them. Harley was still watching us. He still had his gun at Duffy's head. But his wrist was tired, and his finger wasn't hard on the trigger anymore. He had let it slide upward to the underside of the frame, where it was helping take the weight. Villanueva shoved the Mossberg crate across the floor toward me, found the lid. We had only opened one.
"Nearly done," I said.
Villanueva slid the lid into position.
"Wait up," I said. "We left two of them on the table."
I stepped across and picked up the first persuader, stared at it.
"See this?"
I said to Harley. I pointed at the safety catch. "They shipped it with the safety on.
Shouldn't do that. It could damage the firing pin."
I snicked the safety to fire and wrapped the gun in its waxed paper and burrowed it deep down into the foam peanuts, stepped back for the second one.
"This one's exactly the same," I said. "You guys are going out of business for sure," Villanueva said. "Your quality control is all over the place."
I set the safety to fire and stepped back toward the crate, pivoted off my right foot like a second baseman lining up a double play, and pulled the trigger and shot Harley through the gut. The Brennecke round sounded like a bomb going off, and the giant slug cut Harley in half. Literally. He was there, and then suddenly he wasn't. He was in two large pieces on the floor, and the warehouse was full of acrid smoke, and the air was full of the hot stink of Harley's blood and his digestive system, and Duffy was screaming because the man she had been standing next to had just exploded. My ears were ringing. Duffy kept on screaming and danced away from the spreading pool at her feet. Villanueva caught her and held on tight, and I racked the persuader's slide and watched the door in case there were any more surprises coming at us. But there weren't. The warehouse structure stopped resonating, and my hearing came back, and then there was nothing except silence and Duffy's fast, loud breathing.
"I was standing right next to him," she said.
"You aren't standing right next to him now," I said. "That's the bottom line."
Villanueva let go of her and stepped over and bent down and picked up our handguns from where Harley had kicked them. I took the second loaded persuader out of the crate and unwrapped it again and clicked the safety on.
"I really like these," I said.
"They seem to work," Villanueva said.
I held both shotguns in one hand and put my Beretta in my pocket.
"Get the car, Terry. Somebody's probably calling the cops right now."
He left by the front door, and I looked at the sky through the window. There was plenty of cloud, but there was still plenty of daylight, too.
"What now?" Duffy said.
"Now, we go somewhere and wait."
I waited more than an hour, sitting at my desk, looking at my telephone, expecting Cole to call me. She had timed the drive out to McLean at 35 minutes. Starting from the Georgetown University campus might have added 5 or 10, depending on traffic. Assessing the situation at Quinn's house could have added another 10. Taking him down should have taken less than 1. Cuffing him and putting him in the car should have taken another 3. 59 minutes, beginning to end. But a whole hour passed, and she didn't call. I started to worry after 70 minutes. Started to worry badly after 80. Dead on 90 minutes, I scared up a pool car and hit the road myself. Terry Villanueva parked the Taurus on the patch of broken blacktop outside the office door and left the engine running.
"Let's call Elliot," I said. "Find out where he went. We'll go wait with him."
"What are we waiting for?" Duffy said.
"Dark." She went out to the idling car and got her bag, brought it back, dug out her phone and hit the number. I timed it out in my head. 1 ring. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
"No answer," Duffy said.
Then her face brightened, then it fell again.
"Gone to voicemail.
Something's wrong."
"Let's go."
"Where to?" I looked at my watch, looked out the window at the sky. "Too early."
"The coast road," I said.
We left the warehouse with the lights off and the doors locked. There was too much good stuff in it to leave it open and accessible. Villanueva drove. Duffy sat next to him in the front. I sat in the back with the persuaders on the seat beside me. We threaded our way out of the harbor area, past the lot where Beck parked his blue trucks, onto the highway, past the airport, and south, away from the city. We came off the highway and struck out east on the familiar coast road. There was no other traffic. The sky was low and gray, and the wind off the sea was strong enough to set up a howling around the Taurus's windshield pillars. There were drops of water in the air. Maybe they were raindrops. Maybe it was sea spray, lashed miles inland by the gale. It was still way too light. Too early.
"Try Elliot again," I said.
Duffy took her phone out, speed dialed the number, put the phone to her ear. I heard 6 faint rings and the whisper of the voicemail announcement. She shook her head, clicked the phone off again.
"Okay," I said.
She twisted around in her seat.
"You sure they're all out at the house?"
"Did you notice Harley's suit?" I said.
"Black," she said.
"Cheap."
It was as close as he could get to a tux. It was his idea of evening wear. And Emily Smith had a black cocktail dress ready in her office. She was going to change. She already had her fancy shoes on. "I think there's going to be a banquet."
"Quiche and maiden," Villanueva said. "The caterers."
"Exactly. Banquet food. 18 people at $55 a head. Tonight." And Emily Smith made a note on the order. "Lamb, not pork." Who eats lamb and not pork?
"People who keep kosher."
"And Arabs," I said. "Libyans, maybe."
"They're suppliers."
"Exactly. I think they're about to cement their commercial relationship. I think all the Russian stuff in the crates was some kind of a token shipment. It was a gesture. Same with the persuaders. They've demonstrated to each other that both sides can deliver. Now they're going to break bread together and go into business for real."
"At the house?"
I nodded. "It's an impressive location. Isolated. Very dramatic. And it's got a big dining table." He turned the windshield wipers on. The glass streaked and smeared. It was sea spray, whipping horizontally off the Atlantic, full of salt. "Something else," I said.
"What?"
"I think Teresa Daniel is part of the deal."
"What?"
"I think they're selling her along with the shotguns. A cute, blonde American girl. I think she's the $10,000 bonus item." Nobody spoke.
"Did you notice what Harley said about her? Mint condition?"
Nobody spoke. "I think they've kept her fed and alive and untouched." I thought. Paulie wouldn't have bothered with Elizabeth Beck if Teresa had been available to him, with all due respect to Elizabeth. Nobody spoke. "They're probably cleaning her up right now." Nobody spoke. "I think she's headed for Tripoli. Part of the deal. Like a sweetener." Villanueva accelerated hard. The wind howled louder around the windshield pillars and the door mirrors. 2 minutes later, we reached the spot where we had ambushed the bodyguards, and he slowed again. We were 5 miles from the house. Theoretically, we were already visible from the upper floor windows. We came to a stop in the center of the road, and we all craned forward and stared into the east. I used an olive green Chevrolet and made it out to McLean in 29 minutes, stopped in the center of the road, 200 yards shy of Quinn's residence. It was in an established subdivision. The whole place was quiet and green and watered and was baking lazily in the sun. The houses were on acre lots and were half hidden behind thick evergreen foundation plantings. Their driveways were jet black. I could hear birds singing and a far-off sprinkler turning slowly and hissing against a soaked sidewalk through 60 degrees of its rotation. I could see fat dragonflies in the air. I took my foot off the brake and crawled forward 100 yards. Quinn's house was sided with dark cedar boards. It had a stone walk and knee-high stone walls boxing in earth beds full of low spruces and rhododendrons. It had small windows, and the way the eaves of the roof met the tops of the walls made it feel like the house was crouched down with its back to me. Frasconi's car was parked in the driveway. It was an olive-green Chevrolet, identical to my own. It was empty. Its front bumper was tight against Quinn's garage door. The garage was a long, low triple. It was closed up. There was no sound anywhere, except the birds and the sprinkler and the hum of insects. I parked behind Frasconi's car. My tires sounded wet on the hot blacktop. I slid out and eased my Beretta out of its holster, clicked the safety to fire, and started up the stone walk. The front door was locked. The house was silent. I peered in through a hallway window, saw nothing except the kind of solid, neutral furniture that goes into an expensive rental. I walked around to the rear. There was a flagstone patio with a barbecue grill on it, a square teak table going gray in the weather, and 4 chairs, an off-white canvas sun umbrella on a pole, a lawn and plenty of low-maintenance evergreen bushes. A cedar fence stained the same dark color as the house siding closed off the neighbor's view. I tried the kitchen door. It was locked. I looked in the window, saw nothing. I moved around the rear perimeter, came to the next window, and saw nothing. Moved to the next window, and saw Frasconi lying on his back. He was in the middle of the living room floor. There was a sofa and 2 armchairs, all covered in durable, mud-colored fabric. The floor was done in wall-to-wall carpet, and it matched the olive of his uniform. He had been shot once through the forehead. 9 millimeter. Fatal. Even through the window I could see the single crusted hole and the dull ivory color of his skull under his skin. There was a lake of blood under his head. It had soaked into the carpet and was already drying and turning dark. I didn't want to go in on the first floor. If Quinn was still in there, he would be waiting upstairs where he had the tactical advantage. So I dragged the patio table over to the back of the garage and used it to climb onto the roof. Used the roof to get me next to an upstairs window. Used my elbow to get me through the glass. Then I went feet first into a guest bedroom. It smelled musty and unused. I walked through it and came out in an upstairs hallway, stood still and listened. Heard nothing. The house sounded completely empty. There was a deadness, a total absence of sound. No human vibrations. but I could smell blood. I crossed the upstairs hallway and found Dominique Cole in the master bedroom. She was on her back on the bed. She was completely naked. Her clothes had been torn off. She had been hit in the face enough times to make her groggy, and then she had been butchered. Her breasts had been removed with a large knife. I could see the knife. It had been thrust upward through the soft flesh under her chin and through the roof of her mouth and into her brain. By that point in my life, I had seen a lot of things. I had once woken up after a terrorist attack with part of another man's jawbone buried in my gut. I had had to wipe his flesh out of my eyes before I could see well enough to crawl away. I had crawled 20 yards through severed legs and arms and butted my knees against severed heads with my hands pressed hard into my abdomen to stop my own intestines falling out. I had seen homicides and accidents and men machine-gunned in feuds and people reduced to pink paste in explosions and blackened, twisted lumps in fires. But I had never seen anything as bad as Dominique Cole's butchered body. I threw up on the floor, and then, for the first time in more than 20 years, I cried.
"So what now?" Villanueva said 10 years later. "I'm going in alone," I said. "I'm coming in with you."
"Don't argue," I said. "Just get me a little closer and drive real slow."
It was a gray car on a gray day, and slow-moving objects are less perceptible than fast-moving objects. He took his foot off the brake and touched the gas, and got it rolling at about 10 miles an hour. I checked the Beretta and its spare magazines. 45 rounds, less 2, fired into Duke's ceiling. I checked the persuaders. 14 rounds, less 1, fired through Harley's gut. Total of 56 rounds. Against less than 18 people. I didn't know who was on the guest list, but Emily Smith and Harley himself were going to be no-shows for sure.
"Stupid to do it alone," Villanueva said.
"Stupid to do it together. The approach is going to be suicidal." He didn't answer. "Better that you guys stand by out here."
He made no reply to that. He wanted my back, and he wanted Teresa. But he was smart enough to see that walking toward a fortified and isolated house in the last of the daylight was going to be no kind of fun. He just kept the car rolling slowly. Then he took his foot off the gas and put the transmission in neutral and let it coast to a stop. He didn't want to risk the flare of brake lights in the mist. We were maybe a quarter mile short of the house. "You guys wait here," I said, "for the duration." Villanueva looked away.
"Give me 1 hour."
I waited until they both nodded. "Then call ATF. After an hour, if I'm not back."
"Maybe we should do that now," Duffy said.
"No. I want that hour first."
"ATF will get Quinn," she said.
"It's not like they're going to let him walk." I thought back to what I had seen and just shook my head. I broke every regulation and ignored every procedure in the book. I walked away from a crime scene and failed to report it. I obstructed justice left and right. I left Cole in the bedroom and Frasconi in the living room, left their car on the driveway, just drove myself back to the office and took a silenced Ruger Standard 22 from the company armory and went to find Cole's boxed-up files. My gut told me Quinn would make one stop before he headed for the Bahamas. He would have an emergency stash somewhere. Maybe phony ID, maybe a wad of cash, maybe a packed bag, maybe all three. He wouldn't hide the stash on post, nor in his rented house. He was too professional for that, too cautious. He would want it safe and far away. I was gambling it would be in the place he had inherited in Northern California. From his parents, the railroad worker and the stay-at-home mom. So I needed that address. Cole's handwriting was neat. The two cartons were filled with her notes. They were comprehensive. They were meticulous. They broke my heart. I found the California address in an 8-page bio she had prepared. It was a 5-digit house number on a road that came under the Eureka post office. Probably a lonely place far out of town. I went to my company clerk's desk and signed a stack of travel warrants for myself.
put my service Beretta and the silenced Ruger in a canvas bag, and drove to the airport. They gave me papers to sign before they let me carry loaded firearms inside the cabin. I wasn't about to check them. I figured there was a good chance Quinn might take the same flight. I figured if I saw him at the gate or on the plane, I would waste him right there and then. But I didn't see him. I got on a plane for Sacramento and walked the aisle after takeoff and scanned every face, and he wasn't there. So I sat tight for the duration of the flight, just stared into space. The stewardesses stayed well away from me. I rented a car at the Sacramento airport, drove it north on I-5, and then northwest on Route 299. It was a designated scenic road. It wound through the mountains. I looked at nothing except the yellow line ahead of me. I had picked up 3 hours because of flying across 3 time zones, but even so it was gathering dark when I hit the Eureka limit. I found Quinn's Road. It was a meandering strip that ran north-south, high in the hills above US 101. The highway was laid out far below me. I could see headlights streaming north, taillights heading south. I guessed there was a rail line down there somewhere. Maybe a station or a depot nearby, convenient for Quinn's old man back when he was working. Found the house. Drove past it without slowing. It was a rough, one-story cabin. It used an old milk churn instead of a mailbox post. The front yard had gone to seed a decade ago. I K-turned 500 yards south of it and drove 200 yards back toward it with my lights off, parked behind an abandoned diner with a caved-in roof. Got out and climbed 100 feet into the hills, walked north 300 yards and came on his place from the rear. In the dusk, I could see a narrow back porch and a scuffed area next to it where cars could be parked. Clearly, it was the sort of place where you use the back door, not the front. There were no lights on inside. I could see dusty, sun-faded drapes half-closed in the windows. The whole place looked empty and unused. I could see a couple of miles north and south, and there were no cars on the road. I came down the hill slowly on foot, circled the house, listened at every window. There was nobody inside. I figured Quinn would park in back and come in through the rear, so I broke in through the front. The door was thin and old, and I just pushed hard on it until the inner jamb started to give, and then I smacked it once above the lock with the heel of my hand. Wood splintered, and the door swung open, and I stepped inside and closed it again and wedged it shut with a chair. It would look okay from the outside. It was musty inside, and easily 10 degrees colder than outside. It was dark and dim. I could hear a refrigerator running in the kitchen, so I knew there was electricity. The walls were covered in ancient wallpaper. It was faded and yellow. There were only 4 rooms. There was an eat-in kitchen and a living room. There were 2 bedrooms. One was small, and the other was smaller. I figured the smaller one had been Quinn's as a kid. There was a lone bathroom between the bedrooms, white fixtures stained with rust. 4 rooms plus a bath is an easier search than most. I found what I was looking for almost immediately. I lifted a rag rug off of the living room floor and found a square hatch let into the boards. If it had been in the hallway, I would have figured it for an inspection cover above the crawl space, but it was in the living room. I took a fork from the kitchen and levered it open. Under it was a shallow wooden tray built between the floor joists. On the tray was a shoebox wrapped in milky plastic sheeting. Inside the shoebox were $3,000 and 2 keys. I figured the keys were for safety deposit boxes or left luggage lockers. I took the cash and left the keys where they were. Then I put the hatch lid back and replaced the rug and chose a chair and sat down to wait with my Beretta in my pocket and the Ruger laid across my lap.
"Take care," Duffy said.
I nodded. "Sure."
Villanueva said nothing. I slid out of the Taurus with the Beretta in my pocket and the persuaders held, one in each hand, crossed straight to the shoulder of the road, and got as far down on the rocks as I could and started picking my way east. There was still daylight behind the clouds, but I was dressed in black, and I was carrying black guns,
and I wasn't exactly on the road itself, and I thought I might have a chance. The wind was blowing hard toward me, and there was water in the air. I could see the ocean ahead. It was raging. The tide was on the way out. I could hear the distant waves pounding, and the long suck of the undertow ripping through sand and gravel. I came around a shallow curve and saw that the wall lights were on. They blazed blue-white against the dim sky. The contrast between the electric light and the late afternoon darkness beyond it would mean they would see me less and less well the closer I got. So I climbed back onto the roadway and started to jog. I got as close as I dared and then slipped back down the rocks and hugged the shore. The ocean was right at my feet. I could smell salt and seaweed. The rocks were slippery. Waves pounded, and spray burst up at me, and the water swirled angrily. I stood still, took a breath, realized I couldn't swim around the wall, not this time. It would be madness. The sea was way too rough. I would have no chance, no chance at all. I would be tossed around like a cork and smashed against the rocks and battered to death, unless the undertow got me first and pulled me out and swallowed me into the depths and drowned me. Can't go around it, can't go over it, gotta go through it. I climbed up the rocks again and stepped into the bar of light as far from the gate as I could get. I was all the way over where the foundations canted down toward the water. Then I kept very close to the wall and walked along its length. I was bathed in light, but nobody east of the wall could see me because it was between me and the house, and it was taller than me. And anybody west of me was a friend. All I had to worry about was tripping the sensors buried in the ground. I stepped as lightly as I could and hoped they hadn't buried any this close in. And I guess they hadn't, because I made it to the gatehouse okay. I risked a glance inside through the gap in the drapes in the front window and saw the brightly lit living room and Paulie's replacement busy relaxing on the collapsed sofa. He was a guy I hadn't seen before. He was about Duke's age and size, maybe approaching 40, maybe a little slighter than me. I spent some time figuring his exact height. That was going to be important. He was possibly 2 inches shorter than me. He was dressed in jeans and a white T-shirt and a denim jacket. Clearly, he wasn't going to the ball. He was Cinderella, tasked to watch the gate while the others partied. I hoped he was the only one. I hoped they were working a skeleton crew. But I wasn't about to bet on it. Any kind of minimal caution would put a second guy on the front door of the house, and maybe a third up there in Duke's window. Because they knew Paulie hadn't gotten the job done. They knew I was still out there, somewhere. I couldn't afford the noise involved in shooting the new guy. The waves were loud, and the wind was howling, but neither sound would mask the Beretta, and nothing on earth would mask a persuader firing a Brennecke Magnum. So I retreated a couple of yards and put the persuaders down on the ground and took my coat and my jacket off. Then I took my shirt off and wrapped it tight around my left fist, put my bare back against the wall, and sidestepped my way to the edge of the window. Used the nails on my right hand to tap softly on the bottom corner of the glass where it was draped. On and off, faint little paradiddles like a mouse makes when he runs across above a ceiling. I did it 4 times, I was about to try a fifth, when I saw in the corner of my eye the light in the window suddenly go dim. That meant the new guy had gotten off his sofa and pressed his face up against the glass to try to see what kind of little creature was out there bothering him. So I concentrated on getting the height exactly right and spun 180 and threw a huge roundhouse left with my padded fist and broke the window first and the new guy's nose a millisecond later. He went down in a heap below the inside sill, and I reached in through the hole I had made and unlatched the casement and swung it open and climbed inside. The guy was sitting on his butt on the floor. He was bleeding from his nose and the glass cuts in his face. He was groggy. There was a handgun on the sofa. He was 8 feet away from it. He was 12 feet from the phones. He shook his head to clear it and looked up at me.
"You're Reacher," he said.
There was blood in his mouth.
"Correct." "You got no chance."
"You think?"
He nodded. "We've got shoot-to-kill orders."
"On me?" He nodded again.
Who has?
Everybody.
Xavier's orders?
He nodded again, put the back of his hand up under his nose.
People gonna obey those orders?
For sure.
Are you?
I guess not.
Promise?
I guess so.
Okay, I said. I paused for a moment and thought about asking him some more questions. He might be reluctant, but I figured I could slap him around some and get all the answers he had to give. But in the end, I figured those answers didn't matter very much. Made no practical difference to me if there were 10 or 12 or 15 hostiles in the house, or what they were armed with. Shoot to kill. Them or me. So I just stepped away and was trying to decide what to do with the guy when he made my mind up for me by reneging on his promise. He came up off the floor and made a dive for the handgun on the sofa. I caught him with a wild left in the throat. It was a solid punch, and a lucky one, but not for him. It crushed his larynx. He went down on the floor again and suffocated. It was reasonably quick, about a minute and a half. There was nothing I could do for him. I'm not a doctor. I stood completely still for a minute, then I put my shirt back on and climbed back out of the window and retrieved the shotguns and my jacket and my coat and climbed back in and crossed the room and looked out of the back window at the house. Shit, I said, and looked away. The Cadillac was parked on the carriage circle. Elliot hadn't gotten away, nor had Elizabeth or Richard or the cook. That put 3 non-combatants into the mix, and the presence of non-combatants makes any assault 100 times harder, and this one was hard enough to begin with. I looked again. Next to the Cadillac was a black Lincoln town car. Next to the town car were 2 dark blue Suburbans. There was no catering truck. Maybe it was around the side next to the kitchen door. Maybe it was coming later. Or maybe it wasn't coming at all. Maybe there was no banquet. Maybe I had screwed up completely and misinterpreted the whole situation. I stared through the harsh lights on the wall into the gloom around the house. I couldn't see a guard on the front door. But then it was cold and wet, and anybody with any sense would be inside the hallway looking out through the glass. I couldn't see anybody in Duke's window either, but it was standing open exactly the way I had left it. Presumably, the NSV was still hanging there on its chain. I looked at the vehicles again. The town car could have brought 4 people in. The Suburbans could have brought 7 each. 18 people, maximum. Maybe 15 or 16 principals and 2 or 3 guards. Alternatively, maybe only 3 drivers came. Maybe I was completely wrong. Only one way to find out. And this was the hardest part. I had to get through the lights. I debated finding the switch and turning them off, but that would be an instant early warning to the people in the house. 5 seconds after they went off, they would be on the phone asking the gate guard what had happened. And the gate guard couldn't answer, because the gate guard was dead. Whereupon I would have 15 or more people swarming straight at me in the gloom. Easy enough to avoid most of them, but the trick would be to know who to avoid and who to grab, because I was pretty sure if I let Quinn get behind me tonight, I would never see him again. So I had to do it with the lights blazing. 2 possibilities. 1 was to run straight toward the house. That would minimize the time I spent actually illuminated, but it would involve rapid motion, and rapid motion catches the eye. The other possibility would be to traverse the wall all the way to the ocean, 60 yards, slowly. It would be agony, but it was probably the better option, because the lights were mounted on the wall, trained away from it. There would be a dark tunnel between the wall itself and the rear edge of the beams. It would be a slim triangle. I could crawl along it right down at the base of the structure, slowly, through the NSV's field of fire. I eased the rear door open. There were no lights on the gatehouse itself. They started 20 feet to my right, where the gatehouse wall became the perimeter wall. I stepped halfway out and crouched down, turned 90 degrees right, and looked for my tunnel. It was there. It was less than 3 feet deep at ground level. It narrowed to nothing at head height, and it wasn't very dark.
There was scatter coming back off the ground, and there were occasional misaligned beams, and there was glow coming out of the rear of the lamps themselves. My tunnel was maybe halfway between pitch dark and brilliantly lit. I shuffled forward on my knees and reached back and closed the door behind me, put a persuader in each hand and dropped to my stomach and pressed my right shoulder hard against the base of the wall. Then I waited, just long enough for anybody who thought they had seen the door move to lose interest. Then I started crawling. Slowly. I got maybe 10 feet. Then I stopped again, fast. I heard a vehicle out on the road, not a sedan, something bigger than that, maybe another Suburban. I reversed direction, dug my toes in and crawled backward to the doorway, knelt up and opened the door and slid inside the gatehouse and stood up, put the persuaders on a chair and took the Beretta out of my pocket. I could hear a big-inch V8 idling on the other side of the gate. Decisions. Whoever was out there was expecting the gate guard's services, and a buck got 10, whoever was out there would know I wasn't the real gate guard. So I figured I would have to give up on the crawling. I figured I would have to go noisy, shoot them, take their vehicle, make it down to the house real fast before the NSV gunner could draw a bead, then take my chances in the ensuing chaos. I stepped to the back door again, clicked the Beretta's safety off, and took a breath. I had the initial advantage. I already knew exactly what I was going to do. Everybody else would have to react first, and that would take them a second too long. Then I remembered the camera on the gatepost, the video monitor. I could see exactly what I was faced with. I could count heads. Forewarned is forearmed. I stepped across to check. The picture was gray and milky. It showed a white panel van, writing on the side. Keast and Maiden Catering. I breathed out. No reason why they should know the gate man. I put the Beretta back in my pocket, stripped off my coat and jacket, pulled the denim thing off the gate man's body and slipped it on. It was tight, and there was blood on it, but it was reasonably convincing. I stepped out the door, kept my back to the house, and tried to make myself look 2 inches shorter. Walked to the gate, butted the latch upward with my fist, the same way Paulie used to do, hauled it open. The white truck drove up level with me. The passenger buzzed his window down. He was wearing a tux. The guy at the wheel was in a tux. More non-combatants.
Where to?
The passenger asked. Around the house to the right. Kitchen doors all the way at the back. The window went back up. The truck drove past me. I waved, closed the gate again, stepped back into the lodge and watched the truck from the window. It headed straight for the house and then swung right at the carriage circle. Its headlight beams washed over the Cadillac and the town car and the two Suburbans, and I caught a flare from its brake lights, and then it disappeared from view. I waited 2 minutes, willed it to get darker. Then I changed back into my own coat and jacket and retrieved the persuaders from the chair, eased the door open and crawled out and closed it behind me and dropped to my stomach, pressed my shoulder to the base of the wall and started the slow crawl all over again. I kept my face turned away from the house. There was grit underneath me, and I could feel small stones sharp against my elbows and my knees, but mostly I could feel a tingle in my back. It was facing a weapon that could fire 12 half-inch bullets every second. There was probably some tough guy right behind it with his hands resting lightly on the handles. I was hoping he would miss with the first burst. I figured he probably would. I figured he would fire the first burst way low or way high, whereupon I would be up and running zigzags into the darkness before he lined up for a better try. I inched forward 10 yards, 15, 20. I kept it really slow, kept my face turned to the wall, hoped I looked like a vague, indistinct shadow in the penumbra. It was completely counterintuitive. I was fighting a powerful desire to jump up and run. My heart was pounding. I was sweating, even though it was cold. The wind was battering me. It was coming off the sea and hitting the wall and streaming down it like a tide and trying to roll me out to where the lights were brightest. I kept going, made it about halfway. About 30 yards covered, about 30 yards to go. My elbows were sore. I was keeping the persuaders up off the ground, and my arms were taking the toll. I stopped to rest, just pressed myself into the dirt, tried to look like a rock. I turned my head and risked a glance toward the house. It was quiet. I glanced ahead, glanced behind. The point of no return. I crawled on, had to force myself to keep the speed slow. The farther I got, the worse my back tingled. I was breathing hard, getting close to panic. Adrenaline was boiling through me, screaming, "Run! Run!" I gasped and panted and forced my arms and legs to stay coordinated, to stay slow. Then I got within 10 yards of the end and started to believe I could make it. I stopped, took a breath, and another, started again. Then the ground tilted down, and I followed it head first. I reached the water, felt wet slime underneath me. Small, rough waves came at me, and spray hit me. I turned a 90-degree left and paused. I was way on the edge of anybody's field of view, but I had to get through 30 feet of bright light. I gave up on keeping it slow. I ducked my head and half stood, and just ran for it. I spent maybe 4 seconds lit up brighter than I had ever been before. It felt like 4 lifetimes. I was blinded. Then I crashed back into darkness and crouched down and listened. Heard nothing except the wild sea. Saw nothing except purple spots in my eyes. I stumbled on another 10 paces over the rocks and then stood still, looked back. I was in. I smiled in the dark. "Quinn, I'm coming to get you now." Chapter 15. 10 years ago, I waited 18 hours for him. I never doubted he was coming. I just sat in his armchair with the Ruger on my lap and waited. I didn't sleep. I barely even blinked, just sat, all through the night, through the dawn, all through the next morning. Midday came and went. I just sat and waited for him. He came at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I heard a car slowing on the road and stood up and kept well back from the window and watched as he turned in. He was in a rental, similar to mine. It was a red Pontiac. I saw him clearly through the windshield. He was neat and clean. His hair was combed. He was wearing a blue shirt with the collar open. He was smiling. The car swept past the side of the house, and I heard it crunch to a stop on the dirt outside the kitchen. I stepped through to the hallway, pressed myself against the wall next to the kitchen door. I heard his key in the lock, heard the door swing open. The hinges squealed in protest. He left it open. I heard his car idling outside. He hadn't switched it off. He wasn't planning on staying long. I heard his feet on the kitchen linoleum, a fast, light, confident tread. A man who thought he was playing and winning. He came through the door. I hit him on the side of the head with my elbow. He went down on the floor on his back, and I spanned my hand and pinned him by the throat. Laid the Ruger aside and patted him down. He was unarmed. I let go of his neck, and his head came up, and I smashed it back down with the heel of my hand under his chin. The back of his head hit the floor, and his eyes rolled up in his head. I walked through the kitchen and closed the door, stepped back, and dragged him into the living room by the wrists, dropped him on the floor and slapped him twice, aimed the Ruger at the center of his face, and waited for his eyes to open. They opened, and focused first on the gun, and then on me. I was in uniform, and all covered in badges of rank and unit designations, so it didn't take him long to work out who I was and why I was there.
"Wait," he said.
"For what?"
"You're making a mistake."
"Am I?"
"You got it wrong."
"Have I?" He nodded.
"They were on the take."
"Who were?"
"Fresconi and Cole."
"Were they?" He nodded again.
"And then he tried to cheat her."
"How?"
"Can I sit up?"
I shook my head, kept the gun where it was.
"No." I was running a sting. I was working with the State Department. Against hostile embassies, I was trawling.
What about Garofsky's kid? He shook his head impatiently.
Nothing happened with the damn kid, you idiot. Garofsky had a script to follow, that's all. It was a setup, in case the hostiles checked on him. We play these things deep. There has to be a chain to follow in case anyone is suspicious. We were doing proper dead drops and everything in case we were being watched.
What about Frasconi and Cole?
They were good. They picked up on me real early. Assumed I wasn't legit. Which pleased me. Meant I was playing my part just right. Then they went bad. They came to me and said they'd slow the investigation if I paid them. They said they'd give me time to leave the country. They thought I wanted to do that. So I figured, hey, why not play along? Because who knows in advance what bad guys a troll will find, and the more the merrier, right? So I played them out.
I said nothing.
The investigation was slow, wasn't it? You must have noticed that. Weeks and weeks. It was real slow.
Slow as molasses, I thought.
Then yesterday happened. I got the Syrians and the Lebanese and the Iranians in the back, then the Iraqis, who were the big fish. So I figured it was time to put your guys in the bag, too. They came over for their final payoff. It was a lot of money. But Frasconi wanted it all. He hit me over the head. I came around and found he had sliced Cole up. He was a crazy man, believe me. I got to a gun in a drawer and shot him.
So why did you run?
Because I was freaked. I'm a Pentagon guy. I never saw blood before. And I didn't know who else might be in it with your guys. There could have been more.
Frasconi and Cole, I thought.
You're very good, he said to me. You came right here.
I nodded, thought back to his 8-page bio in Cole's tidy handwriting. Parents' occupation, childhood home. Whose idea was it?
Originally? Frasconi's, of course. He outranked her.
What was her name? I saw a flicker in his eyes.
Cole,
he said. I nodded again. She had gone out to make the arrest in dress greens, a black acetate nameplate above her right breast. Cole, gender neutral. Uniform, female enlisted, the nameplate is adjusted to individual figure differences and centered horizontally on the right side between 1 and 2 inches above the top button of the coat. He would have seen it as soon as she walked in the door. First name. He paused.
Don't recall.
Frasconi's first name? Uniform, male officer, the nameplate is centered on the right side breast pocket, flap, equidistant between the seam and the button.
I don't recall.
Try.
I can't recall it. It's only a detail.
3 out of 10. Call it an E.
What?
Your performance. A failing grade.
What?
Your dad was a railroad worker. Your mom was a homemaker. Your full name is Francis Xavier Quinn.
So?
Investigations are like that, I said. You plan to put somebody in the bag, you find out all about them first. You were playing those two for weeks and weeks and never found out their first names, never looked at their service records, never made any notes, never filed any reports. He said nothing. And Frasconi never had an idea in his life, never even took a dump unless somebody told him to. Nobody connected to those two would ever say Frasconi and Cole. They'd say Cole and Frasconi. You were dirty all the way, and you never saw my guys in your life before the exact minute they showed up at your house to arrest you, and you killed them both. He proved I was right by trying to fight me. I was ready for him. He started to scramble up. I knocked him back down, a lot harder than I really needed to. He was still unconscious when I put him in the trunk of his car, still unconscious when I transferred him to the trunk of mine, behind the abandoned diner.
I drove a little way south on US 101 and took a right that led toward the Pacific. I stopped on a gravel turnout. There was a fabulous view. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the sun was shining and the ocean was blue. The turnout had a knee-high metal barrier, and then there was another half-yard of gravel, and then there was a long, vertical drop into the surf. Traffic was very light, maybe a car every couple of minutes. The road was just an arbitrary loop off the highway. I opened the trunk and then slammed it again just in case he was awake and planning to jump out at me. But he wasn't. He was starved of air and barely conscious. I dragged him out and propped him up on rubbery legs and made him walk. Let him look at the ocean for a minute while I checked for potential witnesses. There were none. So I turned him around, stepped away 5 paces. Her name was Dominique, I said. Then I shot him, twice in the head, once in the chest. I expected him to go straight down on the gravel, whereupon I was planning to step in close and put a fourth up through his eye socket before throwing him into the ocean. But he didn't go straight down on the gravel. He staggered backward and tripped on the rail and went over it and hit the last half yard of America with his shoulder and rolled straight over the cliff. I grabbed the barrier with one hand and leaned over and looked down, saw him hit the rocks. The surf closed over him. I didn't see him again. I stayed there for a full minute, thought, 2 in the head, 1 in the heart, 120-foot fall into the ocean. No way to survive that. I picked up my shell cases. 10:18, Dom, I said to myself, and walked back to my car. 10 years later, it was going dark very fast, and I was picking my way over the rocks behind the garage block. The sea was heaving and thrashing on my right. The wind was in my face. I didn't expect to see anybody out and about, especially not at the sides or the back of the house. So I was moving fast, head up, alert, a persuader in each hand. I'm coming to get you, Quinn. When I cleared the rear of the garage block, I could see the catering company's truck parked at the back corner of the building. It was exactly where Harley had put the Lincoln to unload Beck's mate from the trunk. The truck's rear doors were open, and the driver and the passenger were shuttling back and forth, unpacking it. The metal detector on the kitchen door was beeping at every foil dish they carried. I was hungry. I could smell hot food on the wind. Both guys were in tuxedos. Their heads were ducked down because of the weather. They weren't paying attention to anything except their jobs. But I gave them a wide berth anyway. I stayed all the way on the edge of the rocks and skirted around in a loop, jumped over Harley's cleft, and kept on going. When I was as far from the caterers as I could get, I cut in and headed for the opposite back corner of the house. I felt real good. I felt silent and invisible, like some kind of a primeval force howling in from the sea. I stood still and worked out which would be the dining room windows. I found them. The lights were on in the room. I stepped in close and risked a look through the glass. First person I saw was Quinn. He was standing up straight in a dark suit. He had a drink in his hand. His hair was pure gray. The scars on his forehead were small and pink and shiny. He was a little stooped, a little heavier than he had been. He was 10 years older. Next to him was Beck. He was in a dark suit, too. He had a drink. He was shoulder to shoulder with his boss. Together they were facing 3 Arab guys. The Arabs were short with black oiled hair. They were in American clothes, sharkskin suits, light grays and blues. They had drinks, too. Behind them, Richard and Elizabeth Beck were standing close together, talking. The whole thing was like a free-form cocktail party crammed around the edges of the giant dining table. The table was set with 18 places. It was very formal. Each setting had 3 glasses and enough flatware to last a week. The cook was bustling about the room with a tray of drinks. I could see champagne flutes and whiskey tumblers. She was in a dark skirt and a white blouse. She was relegated to cocktail waitress. Maybe her expertise didn't stretch to Middle Eastern cuisine. I couldn't see Teresa Daniel. Maybe they planned to make her jump out of a cake later. The other occupants of the room were all men. Three of them. Quinn's best boys, presumably. They were a random trio, a mixture. Hard faces, but probably no more dangerous than Angel Dahl or Harley had been. So, 18 settings, but only 10 diners. 8 absentees. Duke, Angel Dahl, Harley, and Emily Smith made 4 of them. The guy they had sent to the gatehouse to replace Paulie was presumably the 5th. That left 3 unaccounted for. 1 on the front door, 1 in Duke's window, and 1 with Teresa Daniel, probably. I stayed on the outside looking in. I had been to cocktail parties and formal dinners plenty of times. Depending on where you served, they played a big part in base life. I figured these people would be in there 4 hours, minimum. They wouldn't come out except for bathroom breaks. Quinn was talking. He was sharing eye contact scrupulously among the 3 Arabs. He was holding forth, smiling, gesturing, laughing. He looked like a guy who was playing and winning. But he wasn't. His plans had been disrupted. A banquet for 18 had become dinner for 10, because I was still around. I ducked under the window and crawled toward the kitchen, stayed on my knees and slipped out of my coat, and left the persuaders wrapped in it where I could find them again. Then I stood up and walked straight into the kitchen. The metal detector beeped at the Beretta in my pocket. The catering guys were in there. They were doing something with aluminum foil. I nodded at them like I lived there, and walked straight into the hallway. My feet were quiet on the thick rugs. I could hear the loud buzz of cocktail conversation from the dining room. I could see a guy at the front door. He had his back to me, and he was staring out the window. He had his shoulder leaning on the edge of the window recess. His hair was haloed blue by the wall lights in the distance. I walked straight up behind him. Shoot to kill, them or me. I paused for 1 second, reached around and cupped my right hand under his chin, put my left knuckles against the base of his neck, jerked up and back with my right and down and forward with my left, and snapped his neck at the 4th vertebra. He sagged back against me, and I caught him under the arms and walked him into Elizabeth Beck's parlor and dumped him on a sofa. Dr. Zhivago was still there on a side table. 1 down. I closed the parlor door on him and headed for the stairs, went up quick and quiet, stopped outside Duke's room. Elliot was sprawled just inside the doorway. Dead. He was on his back. His jacket was thrown open and his shirt was stiff with blood and full of holes. The rugs under him were crusty. I stepped over him and kept behind the door and glanced into the room. Saw why he had died. The NSV had jammed. He must have taken Duffy's call and been on his way out of the room when he looked up and saw a convoy coming toward him on the road. He must have darted toward the big gun, squeezed the trigger, and felt it jam. It was a piece of junk. The mechanic had it field-stripped on the floor and was crouched over it, trying to repair the belt-feed mechanism. He was intent on his task, didn't see me coming, didn't hear me. Shoot to kill. Them or me. 2 down. I left him lying on top of the machine gun. The barrel stuck out from under him and looked like a 3rd arm. I checked the view from the window. The wall lights were still blazing. I checked my watch. I was exactly 30 minutes into my hour. I went back downstairs, through the hallway, like a ghost, to the basement door. The lights were on down there. I went down the stairs, through the gymnasium, past the washing machine. I pulled a Beretta out of my pocket, clicked the safety, held it out in front of me, and turned the corner and walked straight toward the 2 rooms. One of them was empty and had its door standing open. The other was closed up and had a young, thin guy sitting on a chair in front of it. He had the chair tilted back against it. He looked straight at me. His eyes went wide, his mouth came open, no sound came out. He didn't seem like much of a threat. He was wearing a T-shirt with Dell on it. Maybe this was Troy, the computer geek. "Keep quiet if you want to live," I said. He kept quiet. "Are you Troy?" He stayed quiet and nodded yes. "Okay, Troy," I said.
I figured we were right underneath the dining room. I couldn't risk firing a gun in a stone